Hello, and welcome to Some Other Sphere, a podcast exploring our strange world, one conversation at a time. Hosted by Rick Palmer. My guest for this episode is Sharon Hewitt-Rolette. Sharon is a philosopher who writes for both popular and scholarly audiences on the topics of consciousness, anomalous experience, ethics, and spirituality. She has a PhD in philosophy from New York University and taught at Brandeis University before launching her career as an independent writer and researcher. She is also the founder and director of the Mind and Meaning Institute, which brings together world-class researchers to explore new philosophical and empirical approaches to the deepest questions raised by human experience. Soon after leaving academia for a career as an independent writer and researcher, Sharon became interested in the phenomenon of coincidence or synchronicity, strange, enigmatic experiences that aren't blatantly paranormal, but that seem so improbably meaningful that they make us wonder whether something more than chance lies behind them. Her 2019 book, The Source and Significance of Coincidences, presents a wealth of evidence concerning the statistical importance of coincidences, their range of possible causes, and how we can best interpret their implications for our lives. In November 2021, Sharon was named a runner-up in the Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies essay contest for her essay, Beyond Death. This essay summarizes and analyzes the best evidence for life after death collected over the last 150 years. I begin the interview by talking about what first interested her in anomalous and strange experiences, and how that developed as a student, into academia, and becoming an independent researcher. We then discuss her work on coincidences, before focusing on her essay Beyond Death, exploring some of the third-person and first-person evidence that she collected for that, and how scientific research might progress when it comes to investigating the survival of human consciousness. It was a very interesting chat. Enjoy! Sharon, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Rick. I'm really excited to be here.
Before moving into a career as an independent writer and researcher, you did a PhD in philosophy and then worked in academia. Did your interest in strange and anomalous phenomena start at that point, or was it something that you've been interested in prior to that?
Well, it's actually really interesting. It actually did develop right after I left academia, which was, it feels to me now in retrospect, like a pretty big synchronicity. But yeah, I didn't really know anything about parapsychology, didn't know much about near-death experiences, evidence for life after death. I really didn't see any evidence for anything beyond, you know, the everyday world that we're aware of through science. And so when I left academia, it was not with the idea of studying anything in this area. But just a few months after I left my job, I had been doing a postdoc fellowship at Brandeis University for a couple of years. So after I left that, I actually went through one of the, well, the most challenging time in my life, through a romantic breakup that I was going through at the time. And during that period, I actually started to have the first synchronistic experiences that I had ever had. And for the first time, started to think, okay, or the first time in my adult life, at least, I started to think, maybe there is something beyond what we can see and touch. And those first experiences that I had in those first several months were still kind of subtle. They were not, you know, like hit you over the head sort of things, but I was going through such a difficult time, and those coincidences were so beautifully timed to what I was thinking and feeling that they felt very significant to me. And so I started on this path of being interested in this and wanting to know, is there really something to this or not? And so I started doing a lot of reading and discovered that there was way more research out there on this topic than I had had any idea. And so over the next several years, I started reading voraciously about any kinds of anomalous experiences that people had. And it was about 5 years later that I had finally just this enormous synchronicity that happened to me that was so blatant that I didn't have any question about whether it was real anymore. I was like, okay, there really is something else going on here. And I'm so convinced of it that now I'm willing to, step out and write about it in a professional way and, you know, go on the record as somebody who believes that these things exist. And also to try to start figuring out in a more systematic way what exactly was behind these experiences. So it was a transition that happened after I left academia in a very, very clear way, but also sort of happened over the space of about 5 years.
Right. Okay. I'm sure most of my listeners will understand the general concept of synchronicities, but just to sort of go over that, what are these in principle?
Yeah. So a synchronicity or a coincidence, as I like to call them too, it's a meaningful alignment of events that nevertheless doesn't seem to be explicable in any normal causal way. So there doesn't seem to be any obvious explanation for that, but yet there's something. A lot of times it's an event that's happening, you know, somewhere in the external world, and it's aligning with something that you are thinking or feeling. So an internal event, a mental event. And that alignment is so close, so precise, like something that you come across, you know, something that you read or you see expresses very precise details of what it is that you're thinking or feeling at that time, or maybe gives you something that even feels like a message to something that you're, you know, a question that you're wondering about. And the precision of the alignment in those two things is so strong, even though there's no way that your thoughts could have caused that to come about in any normal way, that you start thinking, okay, like, is the world reading my mind? What's going on? Is this God? Is this something else? There feels like there has to be a connection, even though you don't know what that connection would be exactly. So I've been using the word synchronicity today. I tend actually to like to use the word coincidence more because I feel like it's a little more agnostic about whether there is something behind any particular one of these events. And I think we need to stay open to that question. If we're noticing them, it's something that feels very meaningful to us at the time. But I think we need to stay in that questioning space of, okay, well, what exactly does it mean? Is there something outside of me that is trying to communicate with me in some way? And sometimes I think calling them coincidences rather than synchronicity helps us stay in that more agnostic space where we can continue to learn about these events. That's the long answer to your question.
No, that was great. When I think of meaningful coincidences and synchronicities, the name that comes to mind is Carl Jung.
Oh, yeah.
Were people looking into this sort of thing prior to him? And what sort of research has been done after he died?
Yeah. So definitely people were looking into it before him. One of the people who comes to mind is Paul Kammerer, early 1900s, like 1910s, I think. He wrote at least one big book about specifically serial coincidences. So like a whole series of things that happen that are all related to each other or sort of build on each other in some way. And he was just, he would catalog these things. Like he had just just so many notes and records of all of these things that had happened to him. And he was looking for these, like, you know, statistical patterns in them. And then Jung came along, and Jung, as a psychiatrist, had this very psychological interpretation of what was happening, and specifically was interested in the way that these events would transform people's understandings of themselves and aid them in the process of what he called individuation, of coming to a better understanding of themselves and their ability to act in the world. And Jung is the one who actually coined the term synchronicity, that has really caught on as a synonym for meaningful coincidence. He had a pretty specific theory about what was behind these synchronicities or coincidences. He thought that there were psychological archetypes that were sort of manifesting themselves through these events. So these sort of almost mythological patterns that would manifest themselves in everybody's life. And it's very intriguing to read his theories. I don't find that the archetypal interpretation of coincidences is that useful to me personally. And that's another reason that I kind of like the term coincidence instead of synchronicity. But he's had a massive influence on culture just by highlighting the fact that this is a real phenomenon and that this really does impact people's lives in a major way and often lead to a lot of personal growth in people's lives. And he also had a collaboration with the physicist Wolfgang Pauli. And I think that's something that really excites people too, because the idea of a physicist being interested in coincidence seems to give it this, you know, extra cachet and legitimacy. And so, you know, Pauli and Jung were like this, you know, power couple talking about synchronicity. So they really got things going and it really, you know, got the idea out there into the popular culture. In more recent days, because let's see, I think Jung's book on synchronicity was late 50s, early 60s. So, you know, it's been about half a century or more since then. And we've had a lot more popular works on coincidence. Another academic who has done some work on this is Bernie Beitman. And he's, you know, tried to do some more systematic surveys and, you know, develop some theories about how these coincidences might work. He talks about the psychosphere, this sort of realm of consciousness in which our different minds interact in creating these events. But I feel like part of why I got into writing about coincidence and wrote such an enormous book about it. My book is like 600 pages long. It's more of a reference work than easy reading. But part of why I got into it is that I really wasn't satisfied with any of the accounts, even, you know, the ones by these other academics like Jung and Beitman. I felt like there's such a huge diversity to the way coincidences manifest in people's lives. And I wanted to be really careful not to try to narrow down the theory about what was going on here too early, right? So one of the things that I really try to do in my book, The Source and Significance of Coincidences, is to lay out all the different possible theories about where these events could be coming from, what the source of them is. And, you know, give a lot of examples that seem to point to, you know, for instance, coincidences originating with our deceased loved ones on the other side, or coincidences originating with God, or coincidences originating from the phenomenon of unconscious telepathy or unconscious psychokinesis, perhaps. So we can, the idea there being that we could kind of create coincidences for ourselves in a way, by unconsciously affecting the world around us. So I wanted to lay out that vast panorama of possible hypotheses and show that there's actually, I think there's strong evidence for a lot of these different hypotheses. That there's not really one thing that's going on. It's a very multifaceted phenomenon. But then I also wanted to explore what the significance of these things was. So it's not the question of where they're coming from is one question, but then this question of why are they in our lives? What impact are they having on people? What are they doing in people's lives? Is also a really important question. And I think actually, in some ways, might be easier to answer than the question of where are they coming from, because they seem to have very, I wouldn't say that they're universally positive. Sometimes there could be coincidences that are very unsettling to the people who are experiencing them and can cause difficulties in their lives because of that. But for the most part, coincidences really seem to have this very positive impact on people's lives to help them grow, like Jung would say, help them grow, to help them develop new relationships, to help bring them even like very physical things that they need. You know, people that are in, you know, very difficult financial circumstances, for instance, you know, money arriving from unexpected places, you know, out of the blue. Also providing information that people need in order to, you know, to fulfill their goals, whatever those goals may be. I've also seen a lot of cases where it seems like coincidences come into people's lives and seem to push them towards something like a destiny. So not necessarily a goal that they already had for themselves, but a goal that these coincidences keep showing up in their life and keep sort of nudging them toward accomplishing something in particular, or, you know, being in a certain place, or in a certain relationship or a certain profession. And when these people don't listen to these coincidences, the coincidences get more and more insistent until they relent and they do the thing that those coincidences seem to be suggesting. So there are all of these different kinds of purposes that the coincidences seem to serve. And in that first book, I was trying to really lay out all of that stuff. What I've been trying to do lately, just in the last year and a half, 2 years, is really try to unify all of that more and to try to, yeah, drill down and maybe find that that underlying mechanism that would explain how coincidences manifest themselves in so many different ways, and seemingly can come from so many different sources. And yet what is the underlying attribute of our world that allows this kind of thing to happen? How is the world built that coincidence is a way that we can communicate with each other and communicate with some sort of greater consciousness? And I'm not totally sure, but I'm starting to have some hypotheses about this.
Right, yeah. I mean, Carl Jung is, and his work is something that's come up on in conversations with previous guests on mm-hmm. a range of subjects, and his ideas lend themselves to supporting a lot of Fortean ideas. And I know that in the way he saw meaningful coincidences is a connection between the inner world and the outer world, and an acausal connecting principle. Are those things still an important part of understanding this phenomena outside of his own research? Is that something that seems to be fundamentally important in terms of trying to understand this sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I think part of what a lot of people are trying to figure out is what exactly... So, I mean, you're right. Jung says this acausal connecting principle. Okay, so what I think modern theorists are trying to do is figure out, okay, well, what is the connecting principle? What and what makes it acausal? Or, I mean, should we can call it causal? What exactly does it mean to say that it's causal or acausal? And, you know, some people would say that, well, anything that's, you know, that's operating from outside of time or outside of space isn't causal in the spatiotemporal definition of causality. So maybe anything that's not spatiotemporal is acausal. I actually think that Jung's definition of as an acausal connecting principle is pretty good. I mean, that's probably, I don't know that I would revise that. I think we're just like trying to get more specific about what is meant by that. And I think one of the things that I would say about how that principle operates is that it seems teleological, which just means goal directed, right? So the idea is that it's trying to, that the phenomenon of coincidence or synchronicity is trying to bring about some particular goal. And the way that the coincidences are going to manifest themselves is going to be sort of the, whatever the easiest way is to enact whatever that goal is. So actually, let me give you an example about this, because it's also a really fascinating synchronicity example. And this actually comes from another current synchronicity theorist and another, I don't know that he's a psychiatrist. He's a psychologist, a clinical psychologist. His name is Kirby Surprise, and he's written a really great book called Synchronicity. And one of the stories that he tells in that book is about a time that he was sitting in a car waiting to pick up a friend of his. So he was sitting in a parking lot in sort of an urban area. And he was listening to the radio. And on the radio, there came on this ad for the movie Carrie. So this was like back in the 80s. So this is a Stephen King movie, Carrie. And he had already seen the movie, actually. So he knew that in the movie, this teenage girl, Carrie, is able to move objects with the power of her mind. And specifically, she crushes her family's home in this movie. So he's listening to this ad for this movie, and he starts thinking to himself, like, what would it feel like to have the power to do this? And it also popped into his mind that he had recently seen a National Enquirer headline about somebody doing something like this, like, you know, crushing a house or turning a house over. So he's got this in his mind, and he's like specifically thinking to himself, what would that feel like to have that kind of power? And he looks out of his car window, looks across the street, and there's this little house sitting there. And he's like, what would it feel like to turn that house over? And as he is thinking this to himself, the house in front of him begins to tip over toward him. Like, the roof of the house starts falling over toward him. And now all he can see is the roof of it. And he's kind of freaking out. this is really, really bizarre. So he's got the answer to his question, which is that it feels very scary to be able to do this sort of thing. So he's freaking out. But he has the presence of mind still to be able to say, okay, well, if this is real, then I want to see that house crushed just the way that it was in the movie. So right after he has that thought, the roof of this home just begins to implode. And as it implodes, it's getting like lower and lower. And he sees this yellow bulldozer pull up from behind the house and, you know, crawl up on top of this now pile of rubble. And he realizes that this bulldozer has been there the whole time. But he had, you know, the radio on so loud, and there was enough noise out there that he hadn't heard it there, and he couldn't see it because it was behind the house. So there's this completely normal explanation for this experience that he's just had. And anybody else, you know, in the vicinity that sees this happening, they're not going to think anything weird or paranormal was going on. But the alignment with what he was thinking about at that moment is so enormously improbable that it's very clear that something was going on. And the reason I bring it up to talk about the goal-directedness is because I think this is a great example of how the experience was aiming for that goal that he said, I want to know what it would feel like to do this. And the universe was able to create that experience for him by aligning all of these different events in his environment. And it's also really weird to try to figure out how this alignment would have happened, or to find sort of a beginning point in time to the process of alignment. Because you might think like that his intention or his desire to see the house implode is the beginning point. But then you realize, well, he had that thought because he heard the radio advertisement for this movie. So did his thought go back in time and sort of create that advertisement? What about the fact that he happened to be sitting in this particular parking lot in front of a house that was about to be demolished? Presumably, you know, the bulldozer had already arrived. These people were, you know, set up to demolish this house already. How did he come to have that thought in the exact place where it would be able to be realized in this amazing way? So what I think is the ultimate purpose is that experience, and that it probably didn't originate with his conscious intention or his conscious desire, although that was an important element of the experience, but that there was something larger, whether it's like his higher self that's, you know, outside of space and time, or whether it's something, you know, divine, or it's the universe as a whole, but somehow it was important for the universe to include this amazing experience for him. And so all of those different events were made to come together at this precise moment so that that experience could be had by him.
Right, yeah. Talking there about the relationship between meaningful coincidences and them being sort of goal-related, is there a difference between a meaningful coincidence and a weird coincidence? I can appreciate that. That's probably subjective, but the reason I'm asking is that I remember a few years ago, I was reading a book, the radio was on at the same time, and there was a point on the page where there was a year, and at the exact moment I read that year in the book, the same year was announced on the radio. Now, that was really weird, but I'm not sure how meaningful it was. But I guess its meaning is that it has stayed with me, but only as sort of as an experience.
Mm-hmm. My answer is a little bit complicated, because I think the subject is complicated. Because there are times when things are going to line up in our lives just by chance, right? So, I mean, statistically, you're going to have that experience sometimes. And I know the experience you're talking about because I've had it too. I'm reading, you know, for me, it's like a, you know, some kind of like, some sort of like a technical term or some like word that I'm reading that's not a very common word. But then, yeah, somebody will say it on TV or something while I'm reading it. And it's really sort of jolts you because your mind doesn't expect those things to be connected. But, you know, I read a lot. And, you know, my husband watches TV a lot in the same room. And so eventually, I mean, it's likely just by chance that the words are at some point going to intersect. And like you, I haven't found any particular deep meaning to the words that, you know, happen to be echoed by the TV at the moment that I'm reading them. It just seems to happen sometimes. And so I think it is important to realize that sometimes it can just be chance. Because some people say, well, there is no such thing as chance. Well, I mean, maybe not, but I think it's also quite possible that there is something as chance. And certainly it's possible that a lot of things like this in our lives, these little weird coincidences, are not things that we need to spend a lot of time puzzling over. So whether it was chance or it was something else, it's not something that we need to pay, you know, an inordinate amount of attention to. Because that's one thing I think sometimes people can get a little bit carried away with, paying attention to coincidences and feeling like everything is a sign and I need to analyze everything that's happening to me to try to figure out, you know, what I ought to do. And I actually think that isn't the best approach. I think it is really healthy to be able to just say, oh, well, that was a weird coincidence, and then go on with your life. If it is something that is supposed to be meaningful and you haven't noticed it yet, it will come back. I don't know if you've had that experience, but when I've had some coincidences and I sort of think about it, I'm like, well, you know, that might be meaningful, it might not. And then the next day, I have another coincidence on the same topic. I'm like, okay, now maybe I need to start paying attention. So I don't think, I mean, everybody is different. Everybody has different personality, different tendencies as far as how many coincidences they notice. But I think it's important to strike a balance between not thinking that, or thinking that everything is a coincidence or a meaningful coincidence that needs to be analyzed, and just ignoring everything, even the really meaningful coincidences. We have to find that juste milieu, the middle path.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the podcast. I hope you're enjoying it so far. I have a favour to ask, if that's okay. Once the episode is finished, if you can leave a rating, a short review, and maybe even share it on social media, I'd be very grateful. They're all brilliant ways to promote some other sphere, to help people like yourself find it and increase listenership. If you would like to get in touch by email, I would love to hear from you with feedback or ideas for future topics and guests. The address is someothersphere@gmail.com. Thank you again, and now back to the episode. Finding meaning, I think, can be quite subjective. When it comes to objectively looking at meaningfulness in coincidences, is it like you were saying earlier, the level of event that someone encounters, such as the house tipping over that you described earlier?
Well, I think there's an element of both. I think there's an element of objectivity and a very important element of subjectivity. So for the objectivity, I think that the very precise and improbable way in which an external event matches your thoughts, or two external events match each other, that's really important. That's something that you can quantify in a more objective way. And I've written a journal article trying to show exactly how you can quantify that. So I think that the sheer improbability of that kind of match between your thoughts and the external world, that's a really important objective clue to the significance of what's happening. On the other side, I think another really important clue is a subjective one, which is the intensity of the emotion that you feel as a result. So even something that doesn't feel or doesn't look to, you know, to other people like an objectively really improbable coincidence, if you're feeling an enormous amount of emotion connected to it, or specifically if the emotion or thought that the external event is reflecting of yours is very intense, then that is also a clue that that is something very meaningful that you need to pay more attention to. And I've actually found that this is one of the primary purposes that coincidences serve in my own life. And it's not to say that that's going to be the same for everybody, because I do think that we kind of all have our own little personal styles as far as coincidence and synchronicity. But the purpose that they have most often served in my life is when there's something that I have been feeling and feeling pretty intensely, but not giving myself permission to feel, or not acknowledging or acting on in the way that I should, so that that emotion is, I'm just trying to, you know, repress it and push it down and make it go away, that often at a certain point, external events start to manifest that emotion that I'm repressing. And that makes me realize what I'm doing and keeps me from ignoring it any longer. I have to take it seriously and have to think about it and have to do something about it often. So yeah, the objective improbability, but also the subjective emotion level are very important, I think, in figuring out the significance of those events.
Right. Yeah. Just out of interest, when you were working on your book on synchronicities, did that affect your experience of them? I'd be interested to know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure that it did. I'm trying to think of like what experiences were happening to me during the process of writing the book, and if they were significantly different from what I had experienced before. I don't know if there's a specific way that those experiences change that I can put my finger on. I had some helpful coincidences that happened to me while I was writing the book, like some references that I needed, or like somebody that I needed to contact for permission to publish or reprint her coincidence story in the book. And I didn't have her address. And then I realized, after I had been, you know, thinking, how can I contact her? I realized that bizarrely, like 2 years previous to that, I had ordered a book online and I had ordered a used copy. And when it came from her. It wasn't her book. It was somebody else's book. But this other author had mailed me her used copy, and I had noticed her name at the time on the return address label. And I just thought it was a cool coincidence at the time. So I had actually cut out the return address label and taped it inside the cover of one of her books. And so 2 years later, you know, I'd been puzzling about how to contact this person. And then I suddenly remembered, oh wait, there was that weird time when I got her address for no reason at all and was able to go back, find it in the book, and then write to her and get permission to print her story. So there were like little things like that. I don't know that I reacted to that differently than I would have if I hadn't been writing the book, but they were cool little things to help me along in the process. I do think that at least, if not specifically while I was writing that book, in the years since I wrote it, because that my coincidence book came out in 2019. So in the 5 years since then, I do think that I've gotten less worried about analyzing every coincidence that comes into my life, partly because there's so freaking many of them. But also because I've realized that analyzing them isn't always the most helpful way to approach them. It isn't always the most helpful way to come to an understanding of what they're trying to tell you. Like I said before, I think that the feeling that is accompanying those experiences and the feelings and thoughts that they're reflecting back to you are one of the most important parts of the experience, or the key part of the purpose of those experiences. And the way that you get the benefit of that is not so much by thinking more about things, at least not for me, because I tend to think too much in general in my life. And so the way that I get the benefit from them is to actually feel more. The coincidence experiences will focus me more on the feeling. And instead of trying to pick it apart and analyze it, if I just sit in the feeling and allow myself to feel it and allow myself to just naturally allow that feeling to naturally influence my actions, that seems to be the most healthy, productive way that I've learned to interact with them. And so I really don't worry about them. I don't pick them apart as much as I used to. I just kind of let them come and trust that I'm going to receive whatever message I'm supposed to receive from them. If I'm supposed to be guided in some way by them, the guidance will happen. I'll just let it happen without, you know, worrying that if I don't pay careful enough attention that I might miss something. It doesn't really work like that in my experience.
Okay. So moving on to your essay, Beyond Death, your prior research, what we've just been talking about, did that set you up in terms of researching this subject matter?
It absolutely did, yes. Because I was surprised, actually, when I was writing my coincidence book, how many of the coincidences that people experience are connected to somebody that they loved who has passed on. That's just, if I had to estimate, it would probably be somewhere maybe around 40% of the 30 to 40% of the coincidences that I hear about and read about tend to be related to somebody who's passed on, to seem to be coming from a deceased loved one. So it turned out to be a major part of what I ended up researching for my coincidence book. The longest chapter in that book is about coincidences caused by the deceased. And so when I went to write my book about evidence for life after death, I had done so much research about that and trying to understand the probability that coincidences really could be coming from, you know, the afterlife. Was there really an afterlife? That's something that I had, you know, tried to understand and looked at a lot of different kinds of evidence. So I was already pretty well versed in that when I, you know, turned to writing the essay Beyond Death. And so I had kind of that foundation. And then what I tried to do in writing Beyond Death was to go a little bit further along that path and to deal with some of the, specifically with some of the skeptical arguments that have been made about various evidence for life after death, and try to, in the end, try to explain why those skeptical arguments don't actually hold water, and that the evidence for life after death is, in my opinion, exceptionally strong, especially when you look at all of the different sources for that evidence. So, I mean, we could talk about that more in detail if you want, but.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that the term life after death is, the wording is slightly loaded? Because I think you have described it as survival of human consciousness, and is the survival of consciousness something that's studied at all in consciousness studies? I'm just wondering if it's perhaps the way the phenomenon is phrased or worded that might be a problem for some people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is probably a little bit scary to academics, you know, mainstream academics is certainly like mainstream philosophers. When you start talking about life after death, people, you know, are thinking about ghosts and mediums and thinking specifically too about religion, and religious conceptions of what life after death is like. And there is increasingly this approach to life after death that, like you said, uses the terminology of consciousness, the survival of consciousness, and is trying to distance the study, I think, from those religious associations, even though, I mean, obviously, you know, religion and spirituality have a lot to say about this, but to try to approach it in a more agnostic fashion, to say, okay, well, we're not going to come at this with any preconceived ideas. Let's just see what the data are telling us. What does the evidence say about whether people are still conscious after their bodies die? And turns out there's a lot of evidence that they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking there about the value that religious and spiritual insight can give on this subject, it doesn't really feel like there's any need for all these things to be mutually exclusive, which can feel like a bit of a pity sometimes. I'm interested in all aspects of the perspective on this sort of thing. At this point, I suppose you weren't in academia, but did you find that you had to be careful at all with your interest in this relatively spooky subject?
Well, if I was still in academia, or at least if the academia that I knew from, you know, 10, 15 years ago when I was in it, I would have felt like I needed to tiptoe around this a little bit to preserve my legitimacy as a serious philosopher. Now, thankfully, I mean, the benefit of being an independent researcher is that I don't have to worry about that at all. I can just research the things that seem interesting to me and follow the data where I think it leads and not worry about what people think. I do think, though, that there is some lessening of the stigma around these things. And that's, you know, coming from just, you know, what I see on social media with, you know, other philosophers, the things that they're willing to talk about, the things that they're willing to say. I think within philosophy, there's been a pretty big shift over the past 15 years in terms of willingness to consider other theories of consciousness, and the you know, the theory of panpsychism, that everything is conscious, is much more popular than it was when I was in school, because I was actually a panpsychist back then, and I felt like, well, nobody else is interested in this. Like, I'm not even going to write about this because who's going to read it? They're just going to think that I'm crazy. Well, now panpsychism is almost passé. Like, this, like, philosophy has moved on to other things, even cooler theories, I think, and probably theories that are closer to the truth. Things like cosmopsychism. So the idea that the cosmos itself is one big mind, and we're all parts of or facets of that single mind. So the fact that people are willing to talk about that is pretty cool. I mean, philosophers, it's interesting. Philosophy is, there are some ways in which I've experienced it to be a very conservative discipline, but then there are also these ways in which philosophers are willing to consider ideas and really consider the merits of ideas that scientists have a harder time doing. I think maybe because philosophers are kind of already sort of on the fringe of academia, they don't feel that necessity to please everybody as much as scientists do. They have less to lose, I guess, reputationally. But I do think that there is a shift that we've been seeing. And more openness to these other models of consciousness, which could be more compatible with the idea of survival after death.
Yeah, absolutely. The essay, you split it into two parts, a section on third-person experiences and a section on first-person experiences. And the third-person experiences begin with apparitions and crisis apparitions as well. That's a really great place to start the essay, I thought. And crisis apparitions as well are going back to what we were talking about with meaningful coincidences. With something like that type of apparition, that there's often a lot of meaning.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the fact that the person is in crisis, it seems to be the reason that they are appearing. Like the intensity of the emotion or the intensity of the need that they feel to communicate with somebody at that time seems to be what is making it possible for them to physically appear to them.
Yeah, and in writing your essay and this section as well, is the autonomy of the apparition when it comes to researching life after death, the survival of human consciousness, is that something that, in what scene?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because so one of the sort of skeptical hypotheses that people give, you know, to try to explain away apparitions, one of them is, of course, you know, it's just like wishful thinking, like you wanted to see your deceased loved one, so you saw them. But then they get more sophisticated too, because you can say, well, we all have this like unconscious psychic ability, and so we can, our imaginations can access psychic information and create these visions of, you know, our deceased loved ones to make us feel better, even though that person isn't really there. But the autonomy that these apparitions show, like you said, really tells against that hypothesis, because they seem to show up with their own purposes and their own goals, and to, in a lot of cases, interact with the person that they're appearing to in a way so as to achieve that goal. So one really simple example of this is just the fact that so many of these apparitions happen before the person who sees them knows that the person who's appearing has died, right? They have no idea, and they don't even have idea that this person is in any danger of dying. But then suddenly they see their loved one in front of them when they shouldn't be there, and their loved one often is, you know, saying something like, you know, I love you, or goodbye, or, you know, it's this last farewell to them. So in those cases, the person that sees the apparition, they weren't grieving. They didn't have any particular need at that time to see this. It really seems to be an event that is initiated by the consciousness of the person who is appearing. And you can see it in other more complicated cases as well. I'm thinking, for instance, so this is an old case. This is back from like mid 1800s. It was actually a case that was collected by a guy named Robert Dale Owen, who is a really fascinating person who created a utopian community back when those were like all the rage in the mid 1800s. But one of the other things he did was study life after death. And he interviewed the people who experienced this particular coincidence. And so in this case, there was this young woman who was staying with an aunt of hers in this fairly large house. And there was a bedroom in this house that had a reputation of being haunted. And one particular night, I guess, because maybe there were a lot of guests in the house, this young woman had to sleep in the haunted bedroom. And so when she was in there, she woke up in the middle of the night and she saw the figure of a maid coming over to her and like bending over and trying to say something to her, even though no words were coming out. And the woman in the bed was really freaked out and she pulled the covers over her head, and thankfully the apparition disappeared. So that, you know, happened, and I guess, you know, she didn't really think that much more of it. But sometime later, I think it was like 2 or 3 months later, she was hanging out, you know, somewhere else with a friend of hers who was into the planchette, which was like the Ouija board of that era. And so they were using the planchette together, and they start getting this message from somebody who said that they were Sarah Clark and said that they used to be a maid in the woman's aunt's house, and that she had been coming back to the house over and over trying to ask for forgiveness for something that she had stolen, or actually multiple objects that she had stolen while she was a maid in that house. And she said specifically there was a silver sugar bowl that she had taken, and she wanted, you know, the family that she had stolen these from to know that she was sorry and was asking for forgiveness. So it's a very elaborate message. But this young woman went to her aunt afterward, and she said, did anybody named Sarah Clark ever work for you? And the aunt said, yes, actually about like 30 or 40 years ago, we had a servant who was named Sarah Clark. And she said, well, you know, she says that she stole some stuff from you, including a silver sugar bowl. And the aunt said that they had always thought that this woman was very upstanding, like they never would have suspected her of stealing. And so they had had a silver sugar bowl go missing and a few other things, but they had never thought that it could have been that woman. And so the aunt said, you know, I don't know if what you're saying is true, but if she did in fact steal those things, then, you know, I forgive her. She doesn't need to worry about it anymore. And from that time on, nobody else experienced that haunting in that bedroom. That bedroom was no longer haunted in the home. And I think this is a really good example of the way in which apparitions have this autonomy. They have this these goals or this goal that they're trying to achieve. They're not hanging around for no reason. This woman's consciousness was really concerned about something that she had done. She didn't feel right about it. And so she's trying to find some way to communicate. Appearing to people in the bedroom is apparently not working. And so eventually she is able to communicate with this niece through the planchette and get that message across. And then once that has happened, then the haunting phenomenon goes away. So there's absolutely that autonomy. And that's not what you would expect if it was just something that was all in people's minds or wishful thinking.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I found that incident really interesting. And I guess something else to consider is that hopefully it's, you know, once you die, it's not exactly the same as it is when you're alive. I sympathize with a guilty spirit. I wouldn't want a ghost to sort of feel like they had to do something in order to move on. You would hope that the survival of consciousness is a different experience to being alive. I'm guessing that perhaps time doesn't exist in the same way. And what people experience when they see an apparition isn't a full continuation of that person.
So tell me more about what you're saying.
So with that case, with the apparition of the maid, I understand what happened and why the apparition appeared, but upon death, I'm hoping that your experience of the world isn't exactly the same once you die. You know, you're different once you die. You're not stuck. I wouldn't want a ghost to sort of haunt somewhere for hundreds of years. I would feel so sorry for it. Essentially, I'm hoping that apparitions don't experience time the same way we do in the sort of the mortal realm.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. No, absolutely. Certainly the things that I've heard from near-death experiencers would lead to believe that time does function quite differently when we are not in our physical bodies. Although interestingly, the specific examples that I'm thinking of right now, everybody talks about how their experience on the other side is a lot longer, like a lot more things happen there in a tiny amount of Earth time. So I'm not sure that that's helpful for you to think about in this case. But presumably it could contract and expand in all different ways. Because I think also from other things that I've heard from near-death experiencers, that how long or short time is depends on what your mind is occupied with too. Like, it's very relative to what's happening mm-hmm. to you, right? So I don't think that we have to assume that because, you know, this spirit was haunting this bedroom for 30 or 40 years that you know, she had a 30 or 40 year long experience of continually coming to the bedroom, trying to interact with people. You know, she may have been doing a lot of other things in this time as well. And not even have been conscious of it as this specific period of time. Everything seems to work so differently on that side. But also the experiences that people have seem to be very individual as well. Like there are sort of many different stages to the transition into the afterlife. And there seems to be a stage, which we see in near-death experiences. And we also see in intermission memories. So children or adults who recall having had a previous life, but then having experienced the time in between their incarnations, as we call those intermission memories. So reported by those people and by near-death experiencers, there seems to be these different sort of levels of consciousness or different ways that consciousness can be experienced. Some of them are very close to the physical world, so it would seem to correlate with the experiences of ghosts, of people trying to interact with living people. And then there also is this stage of the experience where you're not so conscious of what's going on Earth. Only maybe if you specifically, you know, think of a certain person or want to accomplish a certain thing, but most of the time your consciousness is occupied in a some other realm, a transcendental space of some kind. And that can have many different layers too, different kinds of spaces that you can be in, different sorts of things that you can be doing or thinking about, or you know, different beings that you can be interacting with. So yeah, I don't think we should take this Sarah Clark ghost's experience is representative of what happens to everybody when they die. But I do think that there is an important lesson to take from that experience and from the experience of other apparitions that, you know, have been trying to make amends for things, because that's not an uncommon thing for ghosts to be trying to do, that it is important to make amends for things while you're still in your living body. If you don't want to have to worry about that on the other side, then take care of it now so that you're not stuck trying to communicate with people, because it's a lot harder from the other side. It's a lot easier over here.
Yeah. And I guess as well, it's meaningful for the deceased, isn't it? Going back to meaning.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it shows a new spiritual awareness on the part of this maid, who obviously had never apologized for this while she was alive, hadn't, you know, been willing to confess to that. But then on the other side, she realizes, no, this is important to me. It's important that I say that I'm sorry for this and that I'm released from this. It was something that was on her mind. And so the idea that, yeah, we can carry things with us into the afterlife, things that have been important to us or are weighing on us, will follow us if they're not resolved in some way.
Yeah. We're almost out of time, but I do want to talk about phantom phone calls, which you include in your essay. That's a very interesting subject because it indicates that the phenomenon can adapt to technology.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating subject. And so for your listeners, we're talking about people who get apparent phone calls from people who are deceased. So this is like a new wave of apparitions. So people do still, you know, today see their loved ones as an apparition, but also very common is for people to hear the phone ring, pick it up and hear their deceased loved one on the other end. And often it will be just a very brief conversation. Sometimes they'll just hear, you know, their loved one say, you know, one sentence or something like, I love you, I have to go, or something like that. But then there are other cases where there'll be a whole conversation, because I actually, two of my dear friends have had full-on conversations with their deceased loved ones. It's probably not a coincidence that both of them are very highly intuitive and have a lot of odd experiences in their life. So they seem to be more open to this, but they both had like multi-minute conversations, and one of them got some really important like family information from this that her family didn't know previously. So that's to set it up, what the phenomenon is, and yet it does seem like this new way that our loved ones have found to communicate with us given the advent of this technology. Now, what's weird is they're not actually using the telephone lines, at least in most cases. It doesn't seem like they're actually, it's not like they're using the electricity of the phone somehow and actually physically sending their voice through the phone, because in most of these cases, when somebody tries to trace the phone call, the telephone company has no record of the phone call whatsoever. So it does not show up as having been a call that was placed to their phone, even though their phone rang and even though they spoke to the person through their phone. So it's almost like the deceased is using the symbolism of the phone, or using the habit, the psychological habit that we have of the phone. Like, it just seems normal to us to be able to talk to someone through the phone. And so rather than like a disembodied voice that's, you know, coming out of the air somewhere to us, that would seem weird. I mean, it still seems weird to talk to your deceased loved one on the phone, but there's a little bit more element of normalcy. Like, when you first pick up the phone, you hear the voice, like you're thinking, oh, this is totally normal. And you don't have the psychological block that you might have if you start hearing a voice out of the blue. Because there's still, like, in the back of your mind, there's a thought, well, you know, this could just, maybe this is a prank call, or maybe this is, you know, it's just like somebody calling me by accident that happens to sound exactly like my loved one and know all of this stuff about me. So you can kind of open up your psyche to that experience and, yeah, allow it in a way that you couldn't if it were a weirder experience.
Yeah, I think you're right there with the symbolic meaning of the telephone. I have to admit, I am curious as to whether there are telephones in the spirit realm. That would be quite interesting.
I think it was Robert Moss. So he's written a lot about coincidence and psychic dreams and things. And I think he had a psychic dream about switchboard operators in the afterlife, and like angels who are connecting all of the phone calls and things, which I still think is like a, you know, a symbolic representation of what's happening, but still energetically there may be, you know, that kind of work that has to be done somehow to try to connect people in a telepathic way.
Yeah, I'm not against the idea of a cosmic, like an ethereal phone network. I think that's quite a fun idea. But yeah, that whole area is fascinating.
Well, and I'll just add very quickly that with the new technology of texting, that now people are getting texts from their deceased loved ones. So it continues to evolve.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, Sharon, this has been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Rick. Thanks for being willing to talk about such a wide range of subjects and having such great questions.
If people want to find out more about yourself and your writing and your research, how best do they do that?
They can find me on my website, which is SharonRawlett.com. Rawlett spelled R-A-W-L-E-T-T-E. You can also find me on Facebook. I've got an author page on there, or on Twitter. So yeah, any of those ways.
Perfect. Well, I'll put that information in the show notes.
Great.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you for listening to my conversation with Sharon. I hope you found it interesting. Her research is varied and extensive, and we really just scratched the surface of that in the interview. So definitely check out her website if you enjoyed this episode. As always, I would be very grateful if you could also rate it and leave a short review wherever you listen, as it really helps to promote the podcast and grow an audience. Sharing it on social media, or even just telling a friend, is really helpful too. You can follow Some of the Sphere on X and Blue Sky, and subscribe on most of the well-known podcast platforms. You can also support the upkeep of the podcast with a donation via Ko-fi. Details on how to do that are in the show notes. If you'd like to email me here at SphereHQ, the address is someofthesphere@gmail.com. It'd be lovely to hear from you, with your thoughts and feedback on an episode you've recently listened to, or suggestions for future guests and topics. Until next time, be safe, happy and well, and join me again soon for another episode of Some Other Sphere.